Hello, everyone, and welcome back to 33 Voices Dialogues, where we get to talk to some of the world's most distinguished thinkers and doers on ways their point of view and perspective can help you accelerate your growth. And I have been waiting to get this guy on our program for a long, long time for many reasons, but as I just shared with him, most notably his approach to life. By all accounts, Derek Sivers is a big-time success. He was the brainchild behind the online indie music store CD Baby before it was sold in 2008. He went on to found several companies, from Muckwork, where he connected musicians to assistants, to Wood Egg. It seems like he could come up with these fascinating names, Derek, which published annual guides on how to build companies. And now and I can go on, but I think you get the picture. But I'd like you to really pay particular attention to how Derek lives his life. So great to be with you, man.
Thanks, Mo. That's a wonderful intro. I really appreciate it.
Well, as I shared with you, I really admire how you've designed your life. Not only have you done it purposely, but you left the vitality, I guess, of the U.S. You moved across the world because you wanted a different life. Tell me what shapes your life philosophy.
I think I've learned through the years, I mean, I'm 45 now, that there are pendulum swings in your life. There are times in your life when you need one approach and times when you need a different one. And you don't need to define yourself too early. I think sometimes we start making public pronouncements of, this is who I am, this is what I stand for, this is just the kind of guy I am. And then you find yourself reluctantly continuing to live by those things that you proclaimed because you don't want to go back on your word 6 years later when those things no longer apply. You know what I mean? So I spent a lot of my life being very, very, like, fiercely ambitious, like, trying very hard to get rich and successful and, you know, doing whatever it takes to make a buck at all costs, you know? And I did that for a number of years before I hit a point about halfway through my company, CD Baby, about halfway through its history, I mean, where I just noticed that the numbers in my bank account had gone up to a point where I said, oh, wow, look, I guess I could kind of retire right now if I wanted to. And
that's a pretty good thing. That's a good thing.
Yeah, that was nice. I recommend it to anybody. it didn't change what I was doing in the moment. At the time, I was still completely driven by the things I wanted to achieve with that company. But then in 2008, when I sold CD Baby, what I did is actually the very next day. Like, I went to sleep that night feeling done and complete and went to sleep with an empty head for the first time in a decade or something. But then literally the very next day, Mo, I came up with my next business idea and I, like, threw myself into it immediately and I registered the trademark and I got the domain name and I started programming that very same day. And I got a few months into it before I said, like, wait a second, if I keep doing this, I'm going to stay on the exact same trajectory I've been on for the last 10 years. And, you know, personal growth and development is really important to me. And I don't want to just keep doing the same thing over and over. I want to see life from a different perspective. So in 2008, I forced myself to hit the brakes on my ambition and just start looking at the world from a different point of view. And I'm really glad I did. You know, I would have made more money if I kept on that trajectory and did things that way, but I just had to look at what I had and realize it was more than enough for a lifetime, so there's really no point in continuing to do that. So a lot of the stuff I'm doing now comes from that turning point moment. You know what I mean?
Did you set out to make a lot of money and build a big company with CD Baby? Because, again, it's one of those, it's a great story because it just evolved and it kept evolving. It kept evolving where the market just started saying, we want this stuff.
Yeah. I set out to be successful, but that was actually when I was 14 years old. I wanted to be very successful and at least somewhat rich, ideally doing music. So from the age of, imagine this, from like 14 till 29, I was fiercely focused on getting extremely successful. I wanted to be rich and famous. I wanted to be a famous musician. And man, I was a crazy workaholic. I went to Berklee School of Music, and my classmates called me the robot because nobody ever saw me eat or drink or sleep or relax ever. You know, my friends would like, come on, man, hang out. I'm like, no, gotta be working, gotta be practicing. I was just so fiercely focused on success that I was just one of those, you know, annoying guys that just is inhuman in my pursuit. But when CD Baby started, I didn't want it to be big because I was actually still focused on becoming a successful musician. And I saw CD Baby as something that would get in the way of that. So it was actually like a little hobby I was doing on the side as a favor to friends, but I didn't want it to grow. And, you know, the Tao of business, that, you know, the decisions I made because I didn't want it to grow are the things that made it popular with my fellow musicians, you know, because it was just set up in a very generous way. And so that's what made it successful, when, just kind of funny, I did those things because I wanted to keep it small, but it got big anyway. So, you know what I mean? It's kind of a trick answer that, yes, I wanted to be rich and successful in my life, but I didn't want CD Baby to get as big as it did.
But you say that, and it seems that it parallels with, when you look at all the great success stories today, it almost, that's probably one of the most important themes that come out of there, that we set out to build something that solves a big problem, whether it made us wealthy or famous or whatever you want to call it, that wasn't the point. And it seems like right. Those people just approach the process of building something, Derek, just with a little level, just a little different energy, I think, than people who set out, hey, I'm going to get in here and start CD Baby, and it's got to be sold in 3 years for X.
Yeah.
Yeah, and you know, sometimes I can't help making these musician comparisons, because I was so immersed in music for 20 years that I read many, many interviews with hit songwriters. And very often you'd hear that the big number one hit that this band had was actually a little throwaway song they weren't even going to record. They put, you know, 2 years and lots of money and effort into writing the other 15 songs on the album. And all those 15 songs, they sweated over and toiled over and tried to make them the best they could. And then there was this one little throwaway thing they were singing on the bus, and the producer said, come on, we've got one day left in the studio, just hit record on it. And they said, okay, and that ended up becoming the big number one hit. You know, that, believe it or not, this has happened many times in pop music history. It's not just one anomaly. So there's something to that, you know, that it's kind of Tao of trying too hard at something, or who knows what that is, but it's funny.
What does that teach us about approaching business? Like, you're kind of, we're in the middle of this amazing entrepreneurial technological revolution, whatever you want to call it, right? That everybody thinks they can start the next big thing, and they can, probably a lot easier today than before. But what does that tell us about how to approach the whole process of creating something from scratch?
I think, from my experience, and just even what I've seen in other people too, I've said this twice in this little conversation now, sorry if it sounds like I'm repeating myself, but I call it like the Tao of business, where by being generous, you can succeed more than if you're trying hard to make as much as you can. Do you know what I mean? Like, when people set up a business to maximize profits or to squeeze out every bit of permission from their users that they can, or get away with as much as they can grabbing the users' privacy rights or something like that, you might find that brink of profitability where your customers aren't exactly quitting, but they don't love you. You know, the whole Comcast situation, for example.
Absolutely.
Nobody loves Comcast, but, you know, they've got this board of directors. They want to maximize shareholder value, blah, blah, blah. And so they find ways to squeeze the last bit of profit that they can out of everybody. But there's a different approach to business where you almost see it like public service, where yes, you have to be profitable, otherwise you die. And actually, I think a lot of young entrepreneurs make that mistake more often. They almost get too humble and they say, oh no, don't worry about me, I don't need to make any money. And then they have to go belly up in a year because they need to get a job. But if you find this sweet spot where you're covering your costs, you're making a little profit, but you're generally, you've set up your business in a way that it's very generous to your customers, your clients, then people love you more because of this generosity that you exhibit to the core and really walk your talk, and they feel better about sending everybody your way. And the business ends up growing faster than if you were trying to just do some kind of thing to make money.
Derek, how much of your identity has been or is shaped by the work that you do?
A lot, yeah. I mean, I have a few dear friends that, my best friends and I don't talk about work, really. We talk about love and relationships and even just, you know, questioning the world around us. So that's, I guess, not as much what I do. You know, that's not like career centered, but I find it hard to understand what it would be like to be somebody that's just working a job just to pay the rent, and that's the only reason they're doing it. You know, even ever since I was, you know, a broke 19-year-old, everything I was doing was always with a bigger goal in mind. Like, this is all stepping stones to a bigger path of personal development and improving my skills in order to get to the next level of success or whatever. Everything was always part of a path. So yeah, what I do is pretty intertwined with who I am.
Well, I've been following you, as I mentioned, your work for a while, since literally the early CD Baby days. And one of the things that I've noticed that's very clear in everything that you touch is kind of what you've just said over the last 5 or 6 minutes, that it seems everything you do is tied directly in some way, shape, or form to improving someone's life. First, is that how you approach it?
Oh, definitely. I mean, okay, so even as a musician, I caught some flack from some of my peers and mentors when I was fully immersed in the life of a professional musician. From the age of, from the age of 14 to 29, music was my only pursuit. From the age of 18 to 29, I was actually a full-time musician, just making my living and paying the rent, just doing gigs and producing people's records and touring and whatnot. I even bought a house with the money I made touring, you know, so I was a real full-time professional musician living the dream. But even then, it was not about the end product. It wasn't about making the best possible record or selling the most records. It was about what I was learning along the way. Right, so it was about the process, not the goal. And I remember, if you're interested, there's a story on my blog somewhere. I think it's sivers.org/15 years. Let me check that. Yeah, hey, I love my short URLs. Okay, sivers.org/15-years. Just the number 15-years is a story. I wrote about where it actually took me 15 years to become a good singer, like of active work, like taking voice lessons every single week and practicing my ass off for 15 years. I finally became a good singer. But all along the way, people gave me so much flack saying, why don't you just find a singer? Like, what are you doing? Like, you're obviously just not good at singing. Just give up and find a singer. And I said, nope, this is all part of a process. Like, I'm here to improve my singing. And they just said, yeah, but it sounds bad. I said, well, then I need to keep working at it. And do you know what I mean? If I was goal-oriented, I would have just found the best singer I could and made the best record I could with the best people I could. But it wasn't about that. It was about the process for myself of becoming a better singer. And yeah, after 15 years, I finally did it. So that's an example of my approach to everything, I think, is that the side effect hopefully will benefit other people, but usually the first reason I'm doing anything is to scratch my own personal itch, you know, curiosity. Just playing like a kid playing with Legos. It's just something I want to do that hopefully is beneficial to others also. But for the most part, it first has to be something I find fascinating and want to improve about myself.
And you just kind of said, in between the words you just said, one of the things too that just has really evolved for me in just watching you grow and watching you succeed is you choose to stay very independent. You're not one to expect a lot of people to help you. Again, is that by design?
Yeah, that's a personality trait. That's I'm a nice guy, but I love solitude. I don't know. I'm just off the chart introvert, I guess. I've met one or two people that are more introverted than me, but for the most part, I love great one-on-one conversations like this, but I don't like being around groups of people. It just exhausts me so fast that even when I was running CD Baby, I had 85 employees, and it would just be so emotionally draining to be at the office surrounded by people that I would very often kind of like get there early in the morning, do a couple things I had to, then just like scoot home and just work from home the rest of the day, just all by myself. So yeah, I try to do as much alone as I can. I just enjoy it more.
And obviously it comes across in everything that you do because of your level of openness and so forth. You've built lots of companies. You've tackled lots of projects. When you start something new, as you're doing right now, when you start something new, do you always follow a routine at the beginning? Do you always start a new project or a new company the same?
No, I wish. I think it's I'm not that disciplined. In fact, my friend Tynan wrote a book called Superhero by Design, I think. Superhuman by Habit, that's it. Great book, Superhuman by Habit. Great book about making habits for yourself and letting, designing habits and then letting those habits run your life. And I tried doing it. Like, I really admire his approach to this, but I found that I tend to work best when I throw myself into something completely. So that kind of life where people say, okay, I wake up and I exercise for an hour and then I work on my French for an hour and then I work on my programming for 2 hours and then I spend 3 hours doing this and then I spend 2 hours reviewing my such and such. I've tried doing that, but God, I thrive so much more when instead I just throw myself into one thing at a time and I woke up at 3:30 this morning. I bounced out of bed at 3:30 to get back to the programming I was doing. I've been up since 3:30 this morning, and I'll just do it until midnight tonight because I'm just so into what I'm doing that I don't want to do anything else right now. I will make myself stop for, you know, a conversation like this or to go running or something like that. But for the most part, I love to just immerse myself in one thing at a time.
So definitely no routines in your life.
No routines. Yeah. Not at all.
Life would be pretty damn boring. You're around lots of successful entrepreneurs, maybe not in person, but you've been around lots of successful entrepreneurs. You've seen lots of people kind of take ideas and execute them greatly. What have you noticed through this tenure that you've had between people who are great at coming up with ideas and people who are better at executing those ideas?
Great question. I think the main key is to not hold on too tight to any of your ideas. To feel this sense that you are a fountain of ideas and there are lots of them and there are always more coming. So if you have an idea and the public isn't eating it up, it's not going as well as you thought, then you let go. You say, oh, well, that didn't work. And you get back to trying other things. And just noticing listening to what the outside world is telling you. I have this theory, well, through experience, that you'll know when you've hit something that hits home for people because it feels completely different. I need to explain. What I mean is that before I started CD Baby, from like the age of 18 to 29, I did so many things. I tried so many things. I ran a recording studio, a booking agency. I had a 5-piece funk band, a solo coffee house act, and I had a 2-piece kind of mime thing where I was running around inside a black shadow called the Professional Pests. I don't know. Did I mention the record label? What else? I don't know. I tried a few things in there, and all of them, especially with my band, it felt like constant struggle. It was so difficult, so many obstacles, and always like banging on locked doors, figuratively, you know. Just felt like everything was uphill. Every door was locked. Nothing was going my way. I could try really hard and get some success. I mean, like I said, I was relatively successful. I was able to buy a house with the money I made making music. So that in itself was pretty good. I shouldn't be complaining. But then when I started CD Baby as just a little hobby, it just took off so fast that you could just feel the difference. Instead of feeling like I was struggling and trying to get people into this thing, instead it was just this runaway growth and everybody wanted it. And the toughest part of my job was just keeping up with the demand. So my advice to other entrepreneurs is that when you've got an idea and it's just not really happening, then let go and try something else. I think we're taught that we should all be persistent. Everybody says persistence is key. You need to be persistent. But I think many of us are misdefining the word persistent to mean doing the exact same thing repeatedly for years until you collapse of exhaustion. But I think really persistence should mean sticking with the same pursuit, but trying many different approaches for the same ends. You know what I mean?
Yeah, that's a really great point, because I see that a big part of your life is living each day however you live it, not really worrying about outcomes. If you can have a philosophy like that, it's probably a lot easier to let go of an idea that's not working.
Right. Well, and it's also selfless. If you're really truly serving others, then if you've got some wacky idea and everybody's just saying no, that's I'm not so interested in that, then be selfless. Like, find another idea that is something that the world actually needs and is wanting, you know, instead of get over yourself and let go of this idea. You've got many more. Go try some more. I saw this even in the music business. There were some struggling songwriters that, like, 9 years ago, they wrote one song and it was for their spouse and it means the world to them. And they spend like 10 years in Nashville trying to get everybody to record this one damn song, and just people just aren't into it. They're like, sorry, I don't like that song. And then the successful songwriters I saw were the ones that just wrote 2 to 3 songs every single week, and they kept doing that, which means that they were writing 100, 150 songs per year. And over the course of 10 years, they had 1,000 songs. They just keep writing. And those are the people that end up having hit songs, because there's just always more and more, and they just keep writing, and some of those hit.
Derek, how do you decide what problems to tackle? I know you make it a priority to try to find really difficult problems and go after them. How do you determine, I'm gonna immerse myself in this?
It's either two things. Number one, I feel that there's a huge demand, like people are really asking me to do this thing. And number two, if there's just something that's personally fascinating to me right now, no matter what the outcome may be. So the first one is definitely more generous and serving the world. You know, that's so, for example, we don't talk about it much, but Host Baby was my web hosting company I ran from 2000 to 2008. And it was nothing I really wanted to do for people. I mean, I didn't dislike it, but it wasn't a big, you know, thing I was yearning to do. It wasn't a big idea. It's just that in the year 1999 or so, I just had a lot of musicians complaining to me about their web hosting company, about charging them too much and treating them rudely because they weren't a big, giant IPO.com.
Yeah.
And I just felt like, you know
days,
what?
Man. Those were
yeah, right. And I had learned so much about Linux and server administration and setting up Apache and PHP and MySQL and stuff like that, that I just told three or four friends, like, you know what, I'll host your website for free. Don't worry about it. Like, just let me get you off that stupid web hosting company. And I did this for a few friends, and they were so thankful, and everybody else kept complaining to me about the same thing. I felt like, well, you know what? I should just do a favor for the world and just start a musician-friendly web hosting company. So I started HostBaby, and I just picked some low monthly amount that just seemed enough to cover my costs, and ended up hiring one guy to help me. But it was really just answering the demand, right? So that's ideal number one of choosing what to do, is just people are asking you to do it, and you say yes, you just answer the demand. But then number two for me is just where I scratch a personal itch, you know, follow a personal interest just because I want to. So if you look at this thing I did a couple years ago, a book publishing company called Wood Egg, that was just a personal thing. There was no market demand for that. You know, it's just I was living in Singapore and I was just personally fascinated in all of these countries around me. And I wanted to learn more about Indonesia and Myanmar and Vietnam and Taiwan. I wanted to understand, you know, what's the difference between Taiwan and China? Like, I'm trying to understand, what's the difference between Thailand and Cambodia? I want to understand, like, what are the cultural differences between them? So I thought, you know, I could just go ask a bunch of questions and learn for my own sake, but I might as well just share what I'm learning. Mm-hmm. So I started a book publishing company just really to formalize what I was personally learning. And yeah, sure enough, I lost a ton of money doing it. Nobody bought the books. You know, I think like my Sri Lanka book, for example, I think sold a whopping 8 copies in the past year and a half. So from a commercial point of view, it was a total flop. But, you know, it's just something that was interesting to me, so I did it.
Derek, what role does money play in your life?
For the most part, I see it as a neutral indicator that you're adding value to people's lives. I know that has a lot of emotional baggage for people, mm-hmm. but mostly I just see it as that. Like, I think that's what I really liked about when I was out there as a professional musician, working so hard to make, you know, $200 on a gig or something like that. It was a nice measure of my success. It's like, if I can make money doing this, that means that the music I'm making is valuable, or I'm finding a way to make it valuable to others. So that was a really good measure. I really like that. As of now, I just I feel like the guy that's got a lifetime supply of food in my basement. You know, like there's no point in going out hunting if you've got a freezer with a lifetime supply. So at this point, I guess from economically, I'm retired. I don't do things for the money anymore, which is actually a hard habit to break.
Yeah, and you know, one of the things I've always kind of believed in is that making money is a skill, and it seems like you started honing it when you were really young.
Yeah.
That was kind of part of your personal upbringing. So when you, it's easy for you to now say, if I'm adding value to people, if I'm adding value to lots of people, it's okay to make lots of money.
Yeah. I guess it all just came from that initial pursuit of trying to be a famous musician. You know, whatever. We all have different role models. You know, my role models were never the Mark Zuckerbergs or whatever. It was more like wanting to be Stevie Wonder. So it was still more about the artistic pursuit, but I felt that this is my personal challenge to find a way to make a living doing this, and ideally, you know, be a rich, successful musician. So yeah, I devoured tons of books on marketing and sales and learning how to do this stuff because it was going to help me be a professional musician. And I guess, yeah, I probably did learn some skills. Have you seen Jason Fried from
37 Signals?
37 Signals, now called Basecamp, right?
Yeah.
So Jason Fried wrote an article years ago in Inc. magazine called something about like practicing, how to practice making money. It was such a brilliant idea.
I did read it, yeah. They had it on their blog as well, yeah.
Yeah, cool. I would love if there's a way to link to that for listeners. It was such a brilliant idea that he just said, I really wanted to get to the core of what it takes to to make money. I wanted to practice making money. So I think the idea, I'm doing this from memory, I haven't read it in a couple years, but that he would go onto eBay, find items that looked underdescribed, undersold, buy them, and then ask the buyer to just wait a week before shipping it. Then he would relist the item after buying it with a better description, better photos, better sales pitch, sell it for a higher price, and then just ask the seller to ship it to that new person instead, and he would pocket the difference. And that was just such a wonderful way of getting to the core. Instead of like starting a business and running it for 10 years as a way to practice, I just love this idea of like, you could do that 10 times a day to practice the art of sales and marketing.
I love it. Yeah. And those guys have done an amazing job that we've had them on our program. They're awesome. All right. A couple more questions for you. I know you have a philosophy about not sharing your goals. Why?
I think it's actually kind of misunderstood. I mean, I think there was this one study that I read in a Newsweek magazine once or something like that in passing in 2009. Somebody pointed me to this interesting little article saying that announcing your goals makes them less likely to happen. And it had some caveats. It was only for a certain type of goal. It was only for identity goals, such as, like, I'm going to learn Chinese, or I'm going to run an Ironman, or compete in an Ironman competition, where just announcing to people that you were going to do this thing made them give you some kind of social reward. Like, wow, good for you. Boy, I could never do that. Oh, you're stronger than me. Oh, I could never learn Chinese. You must be smart. And you'd get some kind of social reward for announcing that you were going to do this thing. And internally, that reward would make you satisfied enough that you wouldn't work as hard as if you hadn't announced to anybody. But even then, they found that it made like a 30% difference, and it was only in this limited situation. But the funny thing is, the TED conference was doing an open call for speakers, and so I pitched them three ideas. There was one thing I really wanted to talk about, there was a second thing that I kind of wanted to talk about, and I read this Newsweek article yesterday, that's kind of interesting, I'll toss that in as number three. And they picked me for number three. So suddenly I had to get up on stage as if I'm some kind of expert and talk about how announcing your goals makes them less likely to happen. So it actually isn't something I strongly believe. It was just an article I read once.
But you did a hell of a job on all three of your talks. So obviously there's some truth to what you said, certainly within a group of people that were there. Does anybody in particular influence your thinking? I mean, who influences your thinking more so than others?
Oh, God, the books that I read. I'm such a book baby. If you go to sivers.org/book.
Tons of them up out there. I don't.
Thanks. that's my biggest influence. There's no one person. Even sometimes, you know, people that were an influence on me in the past, I read their newest book and I'm not impressed. So it's really just on a book-by-book basis. Just some things just resonate with me. But yeah, those are my mentors. Every now and then I get people emailing me asking if I will mentor them. But I never had a mentor. I really just kind of let books be my mentors. And you'll usually know what you need to. If you look at a big long list of books that people recommend, you'll see which ones are probably pointed at what you need to do now.
What's your favorite book that you're reading now?
Favorite one I just finished was called Au Contraire, Explaining French Culture, the culture of France, not the country, not the language. And it was fascinating because I thought it was going to be just a brief overview. I'm actually reading, so I realized I don't really understand Europe. I spent so much time in Asia that I decided to pick up like 10 different books explaining the culture of 10 countries in Europe. So I read the one about Germany, and it was cute and lighthearted and actually did explain a few little things. And I read the one about Netherlands, and that was kind of cute. And then I read the one about France, and whoa, it was deep. Au Contraire was written by this couple that's been they actually do this professionally. They help companies in France understand America and companies in America understand France, and they've been doing this for decades. And so they wrote this book explaining the differences in the cultures, but in a very deep way that was deeper than I expected. And really admire it, because that's actually what I was trying to do with the Wood Egg books. It was not meant to be about really how to start a business in Myanmar. It was trying to like understand what the what is the mindset, what is the, I don't know, to me it's kind of, it's applied philosophy. It's interesting that each culture has a philosophy they live by, and they're all correct.
That's a really good point. They are all correct.
Yeah, you can't say that, oh, those people in Singapore are wrong. They shouldn't be like that. You know, it's, each culture has its reasons for the way it is, and it's fascinating getting to understand the reasons why this culture is that way. Yeah, I love it.
And two more really, really quick ones. When you're in the midst of a really challenging situation, a crisis, how do you handle it?
Two things. I used to immediately call somebody wise and detached, somebody that was outside of the situation, far outside, like not even a best friend, but the kind of, you know, person that you only talk to a couple times a year, so that they could see the gist of the situation without all of the confusing minutia details. And give some advice based on just looking at the broad strokes. But then after doing that for a while, I realized that I could first, before calling that person, spend some quiet time and try to imagine what they would say, which is really just a process of detaching myself from the situation a little bit. Yeah, imagining what an outsider that didn't know my details, or you know, imagining what they would say. And so usually I do that first. First, I just try to zoom out and just imagine a detached person, a detached wise person looking at this. And then if I'm still feeling stumped, I call an actual person.
Really great insight. And I know you're not a routine person, but are there one or two rituals, habits that you can't live without?
Nice cup of black tea. short answer, solitude. Yeah. I think I could go without food longer than I can go without solitude. I really freak out if I don't get alone time. Like when I'm doing those conferences, you know, those like 4-day long conferences.
4 or 5 days, yeah, 10 hours a day.
Oh, God. And then like people go to this thing for like 10 hours. They're like, now let's go to the party.
The cocktails.
Like, no. Yeah. Now let's go to the hotel room alone and do some writing. Yeah, I need solitude. That's not a ritual, but it's the only thing. Yeah, I've even fasted for 10 days. I can go without all of my other habits, but I can't go without solitude.
Wow. Do you meditate?
Nope.
So your solitude is your meditation.
Yeah. Writing. I'm always, I don't even listen to music anymore these days. Not that much, because I don't really have any commute. I don't really have much downtime in my life. So most waking minutes I'm writing, reading, or talking.
Well, hey, man, I'm one of those guys who can't wait to see what you're up to next. And after that, because I know that you've got a lot of tricks up your sleeves. You've mentioned sivers.org, SIVERS.org a couple of times. Is that the best place for people to go see what you're up to?
Yep, and in fact, you know, if you're the kind of person that made it this far through the interview, scroll to the bottom of the page and you'll see my email address in a big font. It's derek@sivers.org. Feel free to email me if you have a question, I'm happy to answer it. I answer every email, or if you just want to say hi, introduce yourself.
Great to talk to you, man. Thank you.
Thanks, Mo.